Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Lots of news today. Newt Gingrich dropping out of the presidential race later today. The AP is reporting that that blind Chinese dissident, Chen Guangcheng, is now saying he wants to leave China. We're going to keep an eye on all of this. But we start in Cleveland, where the FBI says agents foiled a plot to blow up a heavily traveled bridge outside of Cleveland. Five men who broke with the Occupy Cleveland movement, reportedly because they wanted to take violent action against corporate America, were charged. The FBI says they got as far as placing what they thought was a real bomb on the Ohio 82 bridge. Henry Gomez of the Cleveland Plain Dealer is joining us. And Henry, you write that the story starts with a paid FBI informant providing information on these five?
Oh, right. The FBI had an informant that they had been working with, I guess, for some years. And the informant had been around the Occupy Cleveland camp and was bringing back information about these five guys, the group, as it broke off from the Occupy Cleveland movement.
Well, and let's be very clear. The FBI has been clear that they see no involvement with the Occupy movement. And in fact, when these young men reportedly try to get more recruits from the Occupy movement, they failed.
Well, exactly. The FBI and the federal prosecutor here in the Cleveland area has been very clear that they are not investigating Occupy Cleveland. In fact, several of these guys were, I guess, discouraged by the fact that Occupy Cleveland's organizers were sort of preaching nonviolence and civil disobedience, and they had then, you know, sort of split off to talk about other methods. This is what the FBI is alleging, to talk about other methods that are more in line with their anarchist views.
Well, so this paid informant is recording these conversations, and we understand from your writing about this that it started small. These suspects were thinking of maybe toppling signs off banks, but then it grew. What were some of the things the suspects were talking about doing?
Their ideas started off pretty scattershot. They had talked about blowing up signs on the top of banking buildings in downtown Cleveland. That was one of the first things that they had discussed. They'd also discussed other targets, such as what's called the Valley View Bridge, which is a huge bridge, a highway bridge in the Cleveland area. That's not the bridge they ended up allegedly trying to blow up. They talked about driving something into the Federal Reserve Bank in Cleveland in downtown, and they talked about a cargo ship. They talked about a Ku Klux Klan location somewhere in Ohio, and they talked about a new casino that's about to open this month in downtown Cleveland. So they really were all over the place. They knew they wanted to make some type of statement, according to the FBI, but it wasn't for a while until they settled on this bridge over the National Park.
Well, this is the Ohio 82 bridge over the Cuyahoga or Haga River there. And now an FBI agent comes into the picture. Of course, they don't know this, and offers to sell them the material to blow up this bridge. And, of course, he's brought in by this paid source that the suspects don't know is a paid source of the FBI. Is there a sense that these young men, some of the Occupy movement people say that some of them were very young and impressionable, is there a sense that would they have been able to go ahead with one of these things they talked about if, in fact, the FBI hadn't come in and offered to sell them bomb equipment?
Well, you know, they had talked about other methods. There's a conversation that's referenced in the affidavit where one of the men that was ultimately arrested is asking about how to make bombs. And, you know, they were talking about bleach, how bleach could be used for some of these bombs. Mm-hmm. And they ended up not going that route. They ended up meeting with this undercover agent or employee of the FBI to buy the devices, inoperable devices, from them. So there were conversations about how to do this. And these guys have lawyered up. There will be arguments, I'm sure, from the defense side as to how they were steered toward these devices.
But meantime, they did place the dummy device at the bridge. They did think that they were going to use a cell phone to set it off. It didn't work. How are people in Cleveland reacting to this? 13,000 people crossed this bridge over the Cuyahoga.
People reacted with shock, you know. The Occupy Cleveland movement itself hasn't been very active in Cleveland since last fall. You know, the weather got cold and there weren't many things going on. And while this group was not acting on behalf of Occupy Cleveland, I think that it came as a surprise that this was a rogue faction, and that people are definitely talking about that angle of things. And, you know, things like this just, you know, we're not used to these types of stories in Cleveland.
That's Henry Gomez of the Cleveland Plain Dealer with the latest on the alleged domestic terrorist plot to blow up a heavily traveled bridge there. Henry, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, as we said, the Occupy movement is denouncing these self-proclaimed anarchists, but they may have some of the same complaints, and our next guest says they should. Because he says, when you think about the great divide in America, you might think Republican, Democrat, male, female, black, white. But Stephen Marsh says you should think young versus old. He says the last 30 years of economic and social policy has been rigged to serve the comfort and largesse of the old at the expense of the young, that baby boomers are gutting the prospects of America's youth. Stephen makes these points in a provocative essay in the latest edition of Esquire magazine. It's entitled The War Against Youth. 20,000 people on Facebook have liked it, but at least one critic says the essay distracts young people from the real threats to their economic security, that if they pick up this clarion call, they might be fighting the wrong army. So let's bring in Stephen Marsh. He joins us online. And we should say you're not one of the millennials, one of the generation you write about, you know, living at home, piling up college debt. You are 36.
Yeah, I'm 36. I'm not of this younger generation. So I'm definitely looking at it sort of as a disinterested third party, if you will.
Well, but a sympathetic one. You say generational conflict is something no one talks about, because who wants to bring up that the old are eating the young when you're all sitting around the dinner table? So start making your case. Let's start with one statistic you cite. You talk about the assets of older Americans in 1984 as opposed to 2008. Talk about that.
Well, in 1984, the asset difference between people over 65 and people younger than 35 was 10 to 1, and now it's 47 to 1. So that's a shocking statistic. But what I really wanted to do in this piece is try and understand, A, why was this happening, and B, sort of what does it mean?
But, you know, we have to stay with the statistics for a second, because that is a shocking statistic, that Americans over 65 had 10 times more in assets as those under 35 in 84, and then 47 times more in 2008. That's a lot. But as you probably know, people are looking at that stat, and progressive Richard Eskow of Campaign for America's Future says that's misstating that stat, that in fact virtually all of the difference between 1984 and 2008 can be accounted for by home values, which of course went through the roof. So in fact, you know, you might have millions more in 2008, but it's the value of your home, and you can't sell it, and you can't, you know, it's kind of a, it's an amorphous thing.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure what difference that makes to the people who don't have houses. I mean, real estate is the major way that the middle class has wealth, so I don't know what difference that makes to the situation. Also, I mean, you know, the reason that there is this huge gap is also because of, like, for example, in federal government spending, $7 goes to over 65 for every $1 that goes to under 12s. That's the shocking statistic, but I don't think that's really the important thing. The question here is how much opportunity do young people have? The really shocking statistics is that only 54% of under 24s are employed right now, which is the lowest number that there has been since they started keeping statistics. 85% of college graduates had to move back home. This is a massive cultural shift. You know, the way to look at this, I think a lot of people have imposed on these statistics, these old economic models of right versus left. You know, the money is really not what is terrible, because I don't really think that most Americans care. They don't feel that people who are wealthy aren't entitled to their wealth. But a country where people don't have opportunity, where young people don't have opportunities, surely that's a country that nobody wants to live in.
Well, right? But tell us a little more about your thinking that, as you say, the money is going to help the old die comfortably, not to help the young grow. Give us some more examples.
There are programs like, for example, the prescription drug amendment that Bush put in, which cost $60 billion, compared to Pell Grants, which get cut, you know, every year and have also been restricted under Obama. These are policies that have a reaction. Also, you know, for example, in unions, it is starting to infiltrate into the manufacturing sector, where older workers, boomer workers, keep their union wages, you know, $35 to $42 an hour, and younger workers get $17 an hour, and it's a split system, and the younger workers will never see the wages of their older compatriots. This is what is called being globally competitive. That's just one example. The amount of tuition, a medical school graduate in 1990 had an average of $25,000 in debt. Now the average is 157. So we've made this decision to have all entry to the middle class made with these massive quantities of debt. That affects the earning potential of young people forever. And it seems like, well, it's a doctor, does it? What does it matter? But that basically means that even if you're a doctor, even if you're the highest skilled professional you can be, you're not really beginning to have any assets until you're 40. this has not only economic consequences, it has enormous cultural consequences, political consequences.
But do you think that this is a generational thing, or is this a political thing? Again, referring to David Eskow, he says it's Republicans who pushed for the tax cuts that, in his view, have caused such disaster in the economy. So is this a boomer versus the young, or is this politics?
Well, you know, I mean, there are two answers to that question, because on one side, you're quite right. Like, a young person voting for a Republican is really like a chicken voting for Colonel Sanders. It's like, it has no, it's just an interest group question. I mean, like, David Frum called the Tea Party like a going out of business sale for the boomers. You know, not only that, but the state Republicans are trying to disenfranchise young people through these voting reform acts, which the ACLU calls, you know, the worst, most egregious voting reform act since the 60s. I mean, this is really, that it is very clear that the Republicans are anti-youth. Now, there's absolutely no necessary reason why that should be so. If you look at the statistics from the National Center for Education Statistics about what young people are like, so, you know, how they value having a job, being close to family, it's shocking to me anyway, because they're so much more conservative than their parents were. In instinct, in attitudes towards personal responsibility, in attitudes towards you know, whether you should try and fix the world or whether you should look after your own family, things like this.
So you're saying they should be natural Republicans, and the Republican Party should be thinking that.
Well, 85% of young people believe that they will never see Social Security. So I think there is a huge possibility of appeal for young Republicans. It's just this active anti-interest group.
So you assign some blame to Republicans, but you say Democrats are, well, in effect, have been too scared and weak. They may have the young best interest at heart, but they do nothing about it. They don't speak up.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, it is very hard to apportion blame, like in the last budget process and so on. I mean, it is genuinely hard to find out what, like, who is responsible for cutting what and what sacrifices were made. I mean, I will say that if you look at how the millennials view Obama and the level of hope they feel in Obama, I mean, it basically falls off the edge of a cliff, right? I mean, it goes from 63% before the election to, I think, 37% last spring. I mean, it really, really declines pretty speedily, and I think that's because they know they're not being taken care of.
That's Esquire magazine columnist Stephen Marsh on what he calls the war against youth. We mentioned at least one critic, Robert Eskow, who says Stephen's essay and the big advertiser-backed Esquire magazine that carried it are actually hell-bent on promoting the right-wing framing that says the most urgent issue is cutting deficit spending, and Social Security is pushing that agenda. And Rich Robert says the real divide is between the very rich and everyone else, and there's no mention in Stephen's essay of that. Well, Stephen poo-poos all that, and he says he has other examples of what he calls the war on youth, unpaid internships, referenced here on the ABC sitcom Apartment 23.
Miss Berman, if you give me this opportunity, I will show you how committed I am to Berman, Marks, and Mathers.
Even though this is an unpaid internship, it requires 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. Okay. When I sleep, which is rare, I do so standing up like a cow.
My time is yours. I'm single, I don't have any pets, and my only hobby is the seasonal raising of window box pansies.
Stop it.
I will.
Excellent.
Our intern's part of a war on youth. More with Stephen Marsh in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking about what Esquire magazine writer Stephen Marsh is calling a war against youth. He says the old are eating the young economically, and he cites these stats. He says since the recession, 1 in 4 young Americans have moved back in with their parents. They've postponed getting married or having children. He says their voting power has been undermined. More than 30 states are moving forward with Republican initiatives requiring IDs in order to vote, while 18% of young people don't have current photo IDs. There are also moves underway to restrict the voting rights of people with out-of-state IDs, and that includes many college students. And then there was that spat over interest rates on student loans. Republicans were against keeping them low before they were for it in that recent congressional vote. But Stephen Marsh, you just told us you blame policymakers in both parties for what you call this war against youth. And you also take aim at employers who have, you say, feasted on despair through unpaid internships.
Well, I mean, internships is one of the greatest, like, Germany has made them illegal. right? I mean, Germany has decided that they are not going to allow these anymore. They have apprenticeship programs in which young people are paid, in which they are nurtured for jobs they can have. That is a responsible approach.
Why? Make us think more about internships. We have interns sitting down
well,
the hall.
In 1980, 3% of graduates had gone through an internship. It was virtually unheard of. It was Washington and maybe the highest Wall Street firms, things like that. Now, virtually everyone goes through multiple stages of internship. I must say, when I got calls from young people, that is what they wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
You know, that was the thing that really, really resonated with them. You know, your work is not worth any money. If you can't get a middle-class job without having to work for free for a year, that creates an enormous economic barrier to getting a decent job. Like, you have to have parents who can support you for a year or go into more and more debt. This is not sustainable.
Well, you also say it feeds into the cycle we started with. The more and more Business America can have interns do work for free, the less they'll hire. Why should they hire?
Disney has 7,000 interns, okay? I mean, does it really not have any money to pay young people to do the kind of starter jobs that people used to have all the time? Even I remember them. You know, I mean, even I'm 36, remember, like, jobs delivering coffee where they paid you.
Yeah. Well, Stephen Marsh, again, you talk about this as a war on young people. Some people would assign, by the way, Disney having 7,000 interns as opposed to paying workers, some people would assign that to something else, to the arrogance and selfishness of corporate America. I mean, some people would not assign that to a generational war. But either way, what would you suggest be done about this?
The solutions are not actually that complicated. Like, don't raise tuition. Don't make it so that every American student graduates with $32,000 in debt. I mean, I saw barons, of all places, talking about how in Europe this is dragging down the economy because, you know, 18 to 34-year-olds basically can't afford to buy anything anymore. You know, like, things like car manufacturers are trying to figure out how to get young people to buy cars, but they can't because they don't have any money.
But how does this happen? Is it, you know, pressure from young people who, you know, have started to take to the streets and things like the Occupy movement? Is it Washington? Who tells colleges to lower tuitions?
Well, I think Occupy is actually a really fascinating case. They have never brought up any kind of generational angst or anything like that. But it seems to me that the primary question they're talking about, which is the, you know, not having opportunities, basically comes down to this question. I don't have an answer to that. I really don't. I mean, Obama had a lot of hope, and that was kind of wrecked. I think the answer will be the boomers moving on. That's kind of a horrible answer to give, but I think that's probably the truth.
You're going to have to wait about 20 years.
20 years, I guess. Is that that long? Yeah.
What about one other thought? I mean, you're talking about older versus younger. Progressive economist Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research says, what matters for intergenerational equity is the overall state of the economy and the physical and natural infrastructure that we hand down to future generations. You know, this idea that, in fact, it's not even the deficit that matters. We need to spend now. We need to build infrastructure. We need to leave that behind. And a good economy for everyone is a good economy for young people.
Oh, that's true. It's just that we're in a state right now where 54% of under 24s are unemployed. I mean, that's the reality of the situation. And that situation is not accidental. That situation is the result of very conscious policies taken over the past 30 years. Yeah, I mean, intergenerational war, you know, I call it that because I wanted it to be very clear that this is the result of action. This is not some demographic accident. This is not something that just happened. This is something that happened because people made conscious decisions that made it happen. But on the other hand, you know, I think one of the things that's really interesting about this particular generational conflict is that there's actually not a lot of animosity in it. I mean, I don't get the sense that young people even hate their elders' music or anything, you know? I mean, there's not even any kind of cultural,
poor things.
Angst. There's certainly no, like, personal angst, right? It's not like, oh, God, I hate those guys, which is something I find, frankly, a bit confusing, but nonetheless true.
But, Stephen, you know, you are 36. Maybe one of the reasons is that there is a government safety net, as opposed to before the 50s and 60s, when the elderly had to live at home with their children. It was the other way around, and there was no help. And doesn't the fact that we do have this social safety net, Social Security, Medicare, doesn't this in effect help the young people today? Because it takes some of that burden off them. And having to pay, you know, in, you know, emergency room costs for what now is picked up by the
Social Security was, well, I'm not sure it does. I mean, I know people with elderly parents who are under a lot of pressure, but I mean, the truth is, like, when Social Security was founded, there were 35 working people for every one retired person, and now it's 3 to 1. So that is just a fundamentally different reality.
Yeah, we still are caring for elderly parents today, even with the government aid.
If you get through your parents' death with just government aid, I think you're doing pretty great.
Yeah. Stephen Marsh, columnist for Esquire magazine, who wrote the article The War Against Youth. It appears in the current issue. We'll link you at hereandnow.org. Thank you so much. A pleasure.
It's a pleasure.
Okay, so now I'm expecting our interns to come running down the hall with pitchforks. So what about you? Do you feel this war against youth, or are you a boomer, maybe working till you drop because your savings were depleted in the financial collapse, and maybe you think you're being unfairly blamed for waging this war? Weigh in, hereandnow.org, or on Twitter at hereandnow, or at hereandnowrobin, sorry, forgot to tweet today, or on facebook.com/hereandnowradio. Love to hear from you. Latest news is next, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, and by Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world, extension.harvard.edu, and by the Institute of Contemporary Art Boston with Figuring Color, exploring the expressive power of color in paintings and sculpture, icaboston.org.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There's been a lot of scrutiny of horse racing lately, including a close look at the tracks. The Triple Crown events, the Kentucky Derby, Maryland's Preakness, and the Belmont Stakes in New York, are all run on dirt. Now, some in the horse racing industry want to end that tradition and lay down potentially safer synthetic tracks. But some track owners say that's too expensive. So, with grandstands increasingly empty, the question is, are they putting profits over safety? With the 138th running of the Kentucky Derby coming up on Saturday, we're taking a closer look at the horse racing industry in a series of stories produced by WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky. Tom Laszlo reports from the home of the Preakness.
When that bugle heralds the start of the Preakness here at Baltimore's Pimlico Racecourse, thousands of people wearing Sunday's best will be in these grandstands while college students party away in the infield. Not today. The infield is just track workers, and the grandstands are eerily desolate. The only people here today are the hardcore bettors and some family members they dragged along.
How are that 3-1-2? How are that 3-1-2?
Like every other stop of the Triple Crown, Pimlico has a dirt track. Critics say dirt is more harmful for horses than the new generation of synthetic racetracks. Former jockey and trainer Michael Dickinson was dubbed the genius of horse racing in his native Britain. He now manufactures Tapeta tracks, a hodgepodge of wax, sand, recycled clothes, and, of course, some secret materials.
We want it pliable. We want it obedient. It's an obedient surface. Unlike my wife, my racetrack will do anything I ask it to do.
The Jockey Club reports nearly 50% fewer horse fatalities on synthetic surfaces than on their dirt counterparts. That's part of the reason Dickinson loves showing off his spongy version.
See how it bounces back? Yeah. It's got life to it. But he's got to have stability from the rear end, so when he pushes it off, he doesn't want to be spinning his wheels.
With so many horses avoiding catastrophic injuries, Dickinson's business is expanding in the UK, Australia, and the United Arab Emirates. It's even the surface for the Dubai World Cup, but those customers are overseas. Dickinson doesn't manufacture his product in the States anymore. There's just no market.
The only reason not to put a synthetic in is a cost. They're about $4 million. Okay, so it's a big ticket item.
It's not all dollars and cents. Another reason synthetics haven't caught on in the U.S. is cultural. Trainer Larry Murray's horses have raced in the Preakness, and he's not sold on synthetics.
It's different. It's different for the horses. They have different injuries because of it. And I don't really think it's any safer. I think a well-maintained dirt track is just as good. But I think that's the key, is a well-maintained dirt track.
It's true. Veterinarian Kathleen Anderson says on dirt tracks, you typically get more chipped and broken bones, while on synthetics, there are harder to diagnose hind leg injuries. Anderson treats horses at the Fairhill Training Center in Northern Maryland, which boasts a dirt track alongside its synthetic. Comparing injuries from the two tracks, Anderson chooses synthetics.
Just like artificial turf with football players, they probably have more stress-related injuries than necessarily concussion-related injuries, and similar with horses.
In the U.S., California took the lead on synthetics. The state's racing commission mandates them. The results are mixed. Santa Anita Park laid a multi-million dollar synthetic course, but has won permission for a return to dirt. Mike Wellman, who directs publicity at the park, says their synthetic surface proved troublesome.
It became readily apparent very early on that we had some very serious drainage problems, and we had a number of cancellations over a two-year period.
The technology is improving rapidly, but the skepticism has hardened, and extra cash just isn't there. Grant Motion trained the winner of last year's Kentucky Derby, Animal Kingdom. He's a fan of synthetics, but says the erratic rollout in California and elsewhere sets the technology back indefinitely.
I'm afraid that we might have already missed the boat with the synthetics. I'm afraid the way they were introduced to racing in this country, I think people are so down on them, I'm not sure that they're going to be around very long.
That's a dire prediction for a technology that's reported to save horses' lives. But for an industry that itself is on wobbly legs, there just doesn't seem to be much appetite for pricey innovations in America's horse racing industry.
That a report ahead of Saturday's Preakness in Maryland from Matt Laszlo of WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky. We have a quick update here on a story we've been following. A court in Montana has dismissed a civil suit against Three Cups of Tea author Greg Mortensen. The suit claimed he fabricated parts of his book. Mortensen told the Associated Press that the dismissal, which of a lawsuit accusing him of fabricating book passages to make money for himself, confirms his faith in the U.S. justice system. You know, the Montana AG charged him with misuse of finances. For more on that story, go to hereandnow.org. Back in 30 seconds, Here and Now. Welcome back. That blind Chinese dissident Chen Guangcheng has told the Associated Press that he now fears for his life and wants to leave the country. This comes just hours after the U.S. ambassador escorted Chen from the U.S. embassy, where he'd sought refuge for 6 days, to a hospital in Beijing. The U.S. said that Chen had made the decision to leave the American embassy and stay in China of his own free will. But Chen is now saying that U.S. officials told him that Chinese authorities would have beaten his wife to death if he didn't leave the American embassy. This is now one of the most serious diplomatic crises in U.S.-China relations. It plays out just as Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Treasury Secretary are in China for talks with Chinese officials. James Fallow is national correspondent for The Atlantic, author of the about-to-be-released book, by the way, China Airborne. So, James, the story is changing over the course of the morning. What do you make of this? The AP is saying it was a very shaken Chen in his hospital room who told them that the reason he left the embassy was because he thought his wife was going to be beaten to death.
I think the main thing we have to say is the reports are changing almost every minute, and so we don't know for sure what is happening. And it appeared, as of last night, we would have thought that Chen all along has said that he wanted to stay in China because he knew that if people accepted political asylum and left their motherland, their political influence diminished hugely. So as of this early this morning, U.S. time, it looked as if he had some agreement to go back to have some kind of protected existence in China. But now there are these reports that maybe he was threatened of consequences for his family. So we don't know, but it looks much like a much grimmer circumstance than we thought a few hours ago.
Well, look, there are so many possibilities, as you said. And, you know, you couldn't make this story up. He is a blind man who managed to climb a wall and then, remembering the feel of the countryside around this home, feel his way towards the people who helped him get out of, you know, house arrest, away from house arrest and to the embassy in the first place. Just an incredible story. And then this deal that we hear about this morning, very tidy because, of course, Chinese talks are going on and this deal sort of wrapped up just in time to continue the talks. Is it possible that U.S. officials might have told Chen this story because U.S. officials might have something at stake in wanting him to leave the country? There's no guarantee that he would have been protected by the Chinese, and there's no guarantee that he might not have provoked the Chinese, putting the U.S. in a difficult situation again down the road.
Yes. I mean, I think that this is obviously the main point about this story is not the disruption it causes to the strategic and economic dialogue talks mm-hmm. later this week with Secretary Clinton and Geithner, but it does have that effect. I can't imagine that Mr. Chen's escape was time to coordinate with these talks. Rather, it must have been just when he could get out.
When he could get out, sure.
but it looks as if things are evolving in a way of maximum awkwardness for both China and the United States. Again, last night it seemed as if the Chinese would want a way to wrap this up before the talks, which they had hoped to have a successful atmosphere for, especially with the Boshi Live scandal brewing in the background. And so now both China and the United States, their governments are being backed into positions that are awkward for both of them.
Right, and you mentioned Boshi Lai. This is the rising Communist Party star who was swiftly demoted, and his wife, jailed with suspicions of complicity in the murder of an English businessman. And in that story as well, a police chief took asylum in an American consulate. Because he wanted protection. And so both stories have that storyline. There's just so much brewing.
Right. I mean, as of 3 or 4 days ago, we would have thought that the Boshi Lai case was the most impossibly melodramatic one you could imagine in modern day China, before the blind civil rights lawyer escaping from his place of captivity. I think what's significant about both of them for the Chinese leadership as it goes through the change over the next year of power from Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao to their successors is that in different ways, these two cases both challenge the legitimacy of the way the Communist Party has been doing business over the last three decades. We know all of its successes, but in the Boshi Lai case, we have a very flagrant example of the corruption and crony capitalism that everybody in China is well familiar with. And in the case of Chen Guangcheng, I think it's worth recognizing the reason for his great esteem among many average Chinese people is that he's not an anti-communist overthrow of the government person. His main point has been to hold the communist government to the standards it lays out for itself in, its own constitutional provisions for rule of law and protection of people with disabilities and consistent policy across the country. So he's been more of a reform from within kind of guy. So to have these two poles of the Chinese system both confronting whether the state can do business in the ways that it says it should is a real challenge for the Chinese.
Well, most pointedly, Chen exposed a campaign of forced abortions in China. Well, we spoke earlier today with John Pomfret of the Washington Post, and he said from his vantage point in Beijing that what he thought was interesting was how the U.S. is being sort of positioned, how you had both a kind of corrupt police chief seeking asylum with the Americans and a vaunted, human rights activist seeking asylum with Americans. You know, as Americans may want to put human rights more on the back burner. So what do you think happens now? You wrote earlier that the U.S. should give Chen asylum. But now, I mean, do they have a choice if he wants to leave?
Exactly. I mean, if Chen wanted to stay in China, of course the United States could not and should not make him leave the country. If he applies for political asylum, this is the kind of case for which that entire category was invented in the first place. Somebody who is being persecuted for his political beliefs, he's being persecuted significantly mainly by local government authorities. And the central government has occasionally tutted, but it's sort of like, say, pre-civil rights era abuse of people in Mississippi or someplace like that, where there's a lot of mistreatment of him and his family in Shandong province. And so if he wanted political asylum, of course the United States would have to give it to him. But it's become so much more awkward now, among other reasons, because he's no longer in U.S. physical custody. It's going to be very hard for him to get out of the hospital where he is in downtown Beijing.
Well, it's just so complicated. James Fallow, national correspondent for The Atlantic, author of the about-to-be-released book China Airborne, on the the complicated story out of China, the blind dissident Cheng Zhongcheng now saying he does want to leave the country after being told by U.S. officials that the reason that the thing that lured him out of the hospital was that the Chinese government was going to beat his wife unless he left the safety, rather, of the U.S. embassy and went to the hospital. And now he fears for his life and the lives of his family and wants to leave the country. James Fallow, thanks for so much for helping us follow this quickly changing story.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. We're going to take a quick break. Before we go, the song says, in heaven there is no beer. That's why we know we're not in heaven, because here on earth, more and more craft brews, and we're going to take a look and a taste in 1 minute here and now. Have have you been to your local liquor store lately, what they call packies or package stores here in Massachusetts, or in states where beer is sold in gas stations? Have you seen the assortment available? According to the Brewers Association, Americans' consumption of beer actually dropped a little more than 1% last year. But you wouldn't know that looking at all the choices. It turns out that while Americans may be drinking less beer, they're drinking more from small independent brewers. There are now more than 2,000. They employ more than 100,000 people. Retail sales were up 15%, almost $1 billion last year. That totals out at $8.7 billion in sales. And all, again, from the Brewers Association, which, are you picking up a theme here, has created American Craft Beer Week to celebrate. That's coming up in 2 weeks. This week, they're holding the annual Craft Brewers Conference in San Diego. Joining us from there, Julia Herz, Craft Beer Program Director at the Brewers Association. And Julia, do we understand you are a certified Cicerone?
Yes, I am, Robin.
And what does that mean?
That's kind of the beer world's version of a sommelier, but I'm kind of a guide towards all better beer.
I should say to start, I'm not a beer drinker, and I went to college. Imagine that. but I have with me a colleague, Kevin, who's going to help us out here. But my understanding is that microbreweries have been around for decades. So what's new with the craft beer business?
I think you've got a localization in our culture going on. And it's not just unique to beer. It's a localization getting back to people being more informed about what they consume and enjoy, look at on the restaurant level. And so the same thing's happening with beer. And supporting your local brewery has become very important to many beer lovers.
I've seen them in the liquor stores. It's just amazing. I mean, there's so many choices. But tick off some that come to mind to you.
We have documented 140 beer styles, and there's 13,000 plus beer labels in the marketplace. And that doesn't even include what's being made at your local brew pub, because those beers are just circulating so quickly and are often not packaged. So I like to answer, and I get asked a lot, what's your favorite beer? And it's definitely the one in my hand at the time.
Well, let's see if Kevin has the same opinion. Kevin Sullivan joins us in the studio. Kevin has several bottles in front of you. Pick
Yum.
One. Poor guy, he has this assignment. But pick one. How about Brinkley's Maibach from the Free State Brewery in Lawrence, Kansas?
So it has a goat on the label here.
That's a traditional thing, Kevin, for a Maibach, is a goat on the label.
Okay.
What does that mean, a Maibach?
Well, it means May, traditionally enjoyed in May. So it's a spring-style beer, so very appropriate right now. And it's a German lager style, but pushing the envelope maybe a little bit more malty or fuller in flavor probably if Foothills is doing what most American brewers do.
Go for it, Kev. What do you think? Maltier?
Yeah, it is a little maltier. It does have a really nice head on it, though, too, which is nice.
That's the foam?
That's the foam on top.
The collar of foam is probably beautiful. This is radio, but we can just envision it.
So, Julia, there's the Brinkley Maibach from Lawrence, Kansas. But can anybody, I mean, how does it work? Can anybody just say, I'm doing beer? How do you have to get licensed?
Well, you have an estimated 750,000 home brewers in the United States. And on top of that, as you mentioned, we have 2,000-plus breweries right now. So, yeah, to be commercial and to sell, there's absolutely a formal system, and you do have to be licensed. And frankly, it's one of the most highly regulated and highly taxed businesses to probably try and get into is brewing a fermented beverage.
Yeah.
And, Julia, I just wanted to bring something up. Since we have a great craft beer store in my hometown of Belmont, something they told me is they have gypsy brewers where anyone can sort of rent out facilities to brew it.
Yeah. Yeah. You've got a lot of creative versions of what a modern brewery is today. And a gypsy brewer is one where they will be very versed in brewing certain recipes, and they'll go around and get certain breweries to help them brew that recipe. And then that brewery often sells that beer under their license.
Huh. Sort of like an incubating system. Well, we've got another beer for you here, Kevin. It's Colette Farmhouse Ale from the Great Divide Brewing Company in Denver.
While he's pouring that, this is from my neck of the woods, out of Denver, you said. Great Divide Brewing Company doing amazing things. And a Saison's traditionally a farmhouse-style ale that's made in the wintertime, a little bit higher in alcohol, probably 7%, give or take. And that farmhouse term, when you hear that applied to a beer, usually means it's a little bit funkified. There's some fun yeast
funkified
in there that'll give it some wild flavors and
kick,
a lot more complexity.
Now, while he's drinking, Julie, you mentioned, 8% did you say alcohol? Is that high for a beer?
Well, Robin, you drink wine, and it's on average 12% alcohol.
Okay.
So it's all relative. And of those 140 beer styles that I mentioned, the average is about 5% ABV or alcohol by volume.
Okay.
Just depends on the beer style.
So what do you think, Kev, of the Colette Farmhouse Ale?
I liked it. It had a little bit of a stronger taste, which I think is what she was referring to.
That's what you're saying, Julia, that it had...
Well, you've probably got phenols in there from the yeast that will give maybe a little bit clove flavors.
That's what it was, a clove flavor.
Ah. Do you actually, I mean, do you have tastings? As we said, you're a cicerone.
Yes.
Sort of like a sommelier. When you have tastings, do you cleanse your palate and everything as someone would with wine?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, you try not to take it all too seriously. It's all about fun and enjoying what you intake. But, yeah, cleansing your palate's a really good thing. Traditionally, in judging, we've got the World Beer Cup going on in San Diego this week, which is the Olympics of beer. And our judges will judge 8 to 12 beers in a flight, and that's about it. Otherwise, they're going to hit palate fatigue.
Palate fatigue. Do you have palate fatigue yet, Kev?
Not yet.
We have one called La Perouse White from the Maui Brewing Company, of course, in Hawaii. It's in a can. Let me roll that over there. Very pretty design. Looks like waves on it.
I hear cans are coming back.
Is that true, Julia?
Yeah, cans are definitely coming back. And you've got a movement going on now of craft brewers today. It seems like every month we're hearing more and more about them packaging in cans. And it's a lighter package, less expensive to ship. They will also argue, the craft brewers that use cans, that you won't have influence from sunlight or fluorescent light. And that will prevent something called skunking,
ooh,
which as sunlight hits a beer, it can and does change the flavors and give you some sulfur aromatics and the like. So cans are becoming very popular.
Okay, so
I'm going to try this one out of the can.
Yeah.
We'll see how it is.
There you go. La Perouse White.
It's good. It says it's a Belgian ale. So does it have wheat in it?
Yeah, a wit. It's a traditional wit beer that is maybe amped up, but definitely wheat is a part of that flavor. And it's probably got a cloudy experience. Are you seeing clouds in there? Are you lost
you
in
know,
the clouds?
I thought you meant
you
as
know,
a result.
It's good. It's light. I tend to like more hoppier beers like IPAs and things like that.
Julie, a couple questions. Are major American companies, you know, looking at this trend and maybe trying to, you know, Budweiser, Miller, trying to co-opt it?
Yeah, I mean, the large brewing companies is definitely something we're watching because they are losing share. Overall, the $95.5 billion U.S. beer market is definitely growing because of craft, but the large brewers, the top 10 brands, have lost barrels over the last few years. And with the shift of American beer lovers being into more flavorful beers, the large brewing companies do have versions of beers that we're starting to see from them that I would refer to as domestic specialty brands. And it's anyone's guess of where that will all go.
My question is, if you're a beer drinker, do you want to beware and make sure that it's a locally brewed beer, if that's part of what craft beer means to you?
Right. If it matters to you to support your local businesses, then you definitely want to be aware of who makes the brands of beer that you enjoy. And supporting your local brewery is definitely a movement among beer lovers.
But I just have one last question. Kevin, how many fingers am I holding up? Julia Hertz, craft beer program director at the Brewers Association, holding its annual conference in San Diego this week, along with the Craft Beer Cup. American Craft Beer Week is coming up. We have all sorts of information for you at hearnow.org. Julia, thanks.
Thank you so much. Heaven.